You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Red Center. I'm here with my co-host, Jason. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm pretty darn good, actually.
Excellent.
Had a little late last night at a Red function, but we'll come to that later, but generally pretty good.
Excellent. Well,
what? Where do we start? As always, let me give you a quick rundown of what's coming up in the episode. We're going to be talking about tripods. In particular, Jace, you're going to be talking to one of the equipment manufacturers.
Yep. I mentioned last episode we're going to start doing a bit of a trip around the head manufacturers and talking to each of the guys about what's the best choice for Red, which is a bit of a recurring question.
And then after that, I'll be coming up with a discussion about Nucoda and their implementation of the R3D in their grading boxes. But before we do any of that, let's go to, with our new theme music, the news.
And now, the Red Center News.
Cool. What do you think? How's that?
Very nice.
Okay.
I didn't know you could play that well.
Okay, so main news is that Red is really up the ante here in getting the cameras out the door. It was 3,400 to 4,300 was last episode. Now we're dealing with 4,300 to 4,700 cameras. 4,700 should be getting out the door November, which is, you know, around the corner by the time this episode gets out the door, which is pretty impressive. Pretty shortly, you'll be able to just rock up to red.com and order a camera and get it. You know, within a few days, I'd say.
Yeah, and interestingly, there was a companion post made during the week that when the Scarlets come out, they won't be on the same kind of long lead time that we've seen with the Red ones.
Yeah, there was a few leaks, I guess you'd call it, from Jim regards Epic and Scarlet. A few interesting little tidbits to keep us going. First of all, the main thing is 2 second startup time. Which would be awesome.
How is that possible?
Well, I guess...
It's got a computer in it. How can it start in 2 seconds? I mean, I can understand that it can show you an image pretty soon.
Well, I guess it's like, you know, your standard digital camera. You know, all of the firmware is firmware. It's in an EEPROM and it's not coming off a hard drive, I guess. I'm not sure what the difference in the way it runs.
Do you know how many times I've updated the software in my Canon 5D?
Never?
No, I have done it. Okay. But it's like twice since I've owned it. Maybe once. I can't remember, but it's very few.
Yeah.
A lot less than I update Red software.
Yeah, and you turn it on and it's ready to go.
Okay.
So that's cool. No more 60-second, 90-second startup times.
The other thing they leaked were these photos showing, you know, Alpha and Omega kind of little things on the camera. Now, from your camera days, is this a universal symbol for anything?
Yeah, that's just your witness mark. It's essentially marking where the film plane is. So deep in the camera, that's where, essentially, if you're running a tape out to focus, that is where your film plane is.
So does that have any significance on interchangeable lenses, mounts?
I don't think so.
So it's really pretty much just putting a photo of that little symbol on the side of the camera is pretty much like putting a copyright symbol photo up.
Everyone's read a lot of stuff into that little symbol, but I don't think everyone said, "Oh my God, interchangeable lenses." No, I don't think it necessarily means interchangeable lenses.
It just means that putting up pictures of little symbols.
I just think it means that they've added this is where your film plane is, which is nice to be able to measure up your focus or whatever. I think what I can glean from this little photo, and again, all of this stuff as always, is in the show notes, is that what it looks like, that is a hinge point. Now, originally in Scarlet, there's definitely going to be a flip-out monitor, and I think this picture is actually, obviously it's on its side. The screws are actually sort of on, it's sort of rotated just to throw us. So I think there's a hinge point of something like that.
This is just a 3D render, right? This isn't anything.
No, I think there's... Yeah, but I mean, they would base their 3D renders off the CAD information, which they'd be milling castings.
I got stuff to do. I'm going to move on from looking at theoretical pictures of theoretical CAD models of tiny symbols that don't mean anything. I'm sorry.
Yeah, look, it doesn't mean anything.
There are more
anything.
Interesting things to talk about.
Absolutely. Well, also, the other thing was that all the EVFs and LCDs will work on Epic and Scarlet. We presumed, obviously, it would work with Epic, but it's interesting to know that you could take your EVF and accessories from your red one and use it on a Scarlet. But yes, what led us here, Mike, was your original comment about the fact that the wait for Scarlet will not be long. We plan to make many of them. Don't worry. So that is really good news because obviously they're going to have to make an awful lot more of these than they are red ones. The demand will be astronomical, I'd say.
And yet the thing that we spoke about before, this, you know, stills camera that does video or video camera that does stills, otherwise nicknamed the DSMC. I might add by them, not by us.
Yep.
Has now gone off the landscape.
Well, somebody in the midst of all of these leaks, somebody, of course, just decided they just, let's just push the envelope that little bit more. I'll ask one more question. What about the DSMC? Give us some DSMC information. And Jim replied, what's a DSMC?
Right.
So it's either got a name change on the way or it's maybe I think it's been absorbed. Perhaps that's my theory. It's okay. Been that Scarlet's come such a long way that eventually essentially the two products have become
on a more practical level then of less, because I'm, you know, really, I mean, this podcast is not trying to feed off gossip. We like talking about real things.
Absolutely.
I have a real 18-85 lens here. What do you think?
It's fantastic. I had a good look. It looks really good. It looks beautifully finished. It's very nice, very heavy, looks very solid. Yeah, well put together. I would have liked you to have a nice bracket to hold it up off the ground, but...
off the ground, you mean to support the weight so that it isn't all coming on
PL mount? Support the weight. It's, I think it's, what is it, 10 pounds? It's like sort of, you know...
It's bloody heavier than the camera body.
Yeah, it's a few kilos, so it's really, you've got to support all this stuff. I mean, obviously, a lot of lens manufacturers don't ship with any brackets, but you're going to need something to support this lens for sure. Element Technica is coming out with something. Duclos lenses are got something in some development, and also OptiTech. So there is a few. As those brackets start to come out, I'll get back to people about them. But don't start putting this thing on your camera without putting something under it at least. But yeah, awesome looking lens. Congratulations, that's gorgeous.
Man, I remember when the
you wouldn't want to take it off, really. 18-85. It's a fantastic range.
Yeah, that's what I thought. We had the 50 to 150 booked, and I cancelled that order and got the 18-85, even though at that stage we didn't even have a delivery date, because it was kind of my dream lens in terms of what I like to work at, knowing that, of course, if I went to 2K, that 85 is effectively turning into, you know, 170.
Right, yeah, sure.
But, yeah, no, it's definitely... it's got a lot of stuff that you could have criticised the original... red zoom for, but I would point out still again that the reason for the nature of the red zoom was to give us an affordable piece of glass. Now, this is also a very affordable, in fact, I think this is probably 20% of what you'd pay for a sort of a similar thing if it wasn't for red, but, you know, still
absolutely.
It's creeping up there, especially with bankers expensive. Being dickheads and world collapses and exchange rates and stuff. But.
Yeah, no, look, it's expensive. It's 10 grand US. That's 8.6 million US, Australian dollars. yeah, I mean, you'd pay that for just a single, if not more, for a Cook S4, just for a single prime. But it looks, yeah, I say it looks beautifully made. Well done, Red. Gorgeous.
Now, also in the, and also we're going to be putting it through with paces in fxphd.com.
Yes, I'd love to chuck it on the camera and have a,
cause we really,
have
I mean,
a look at it.
It almost becomes absurd to be talking too much about a lens on an audio-only podcast. You want to see it and
yes.
What a spoker looks like and how it's responding
yeah,
to
exactly.
Things
proof.
Like breathing. But all of that we'll be doing, obviously, for FXPHD. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that in week three, we're in week, just the start of week two now, in week three, which is next week, we do our lens testing. Hey,
fantastic.
In talking about real things and not sort of hype, we actually got the spectral response curves released this week, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And I got all excited about it and emailed you about it, all gooey and sort of wet and moist. And you were all like,
"What the? What's it? Sorry, can you please?" I just sent back an email saying, "Can you just decipher it?"
What you actually sent back was, "If you say so,
I'll take your word for it." Wow, this is amazing! Check out these spectral response curves.
Oh yeah, I mean, really. Okay, so let's discuss spectral response curves briefly, just so that you guys get an idea. We'll republish them in the show notes, which, as we mentioned last week, aren't actually like four lines of text, but actually, you know, our version of a glossy brochure. In fact, it's actually quite a decent document. We got people actually emailing us going, I had no idea that when you talked about the show notes, it was actually something worth reading. It's like, well, thanks. We only mention it each time.
Stop talking it up. I'll have to make it all the better.
But anyway, it's a good place to go for stuff. And in there, we'll have the spectral response curves. Now, in addition to the one that Red published, which is, Red published two for the Mysterium, and I'll talk about why. One was a normalized curve, one was a relative response curve. There's also been published by other Red users, and we thank them for it, the spectral response curves of the Dulcer, and also more particular of the Genesis. And the Genesis one's particularly interesting. It comes from Sony and Panavision, and it has a film and Genesis set of curves. And so you get to see them. Now, why these are so interesting is that this gives you what the sensor is doing in terms of how it's responding to light. So just to be, I know some of you guys know this and I apologize, but let's just assume that we can carry everyone forward. As you move up the wavelength of light, so you start at say 400 and you go up to 700 or 800, if you go high enough, you hit infrared. And if you go low enough, you have ultraviolet. And somewhere in between those two is visible light. So let's assume visible light, for the purposes of what we're talking about, is 400 to 700. Then the light changes from the violet to the red. And so the sensor is going to be responding at different wavelengths to those lights. So if I pump blue light in, then blue light doesn't exist up at 700 nanometers. It just isn't there, right? Yeah. Okay, so what we want to know is how does the sensor respond to these three different primaries? Because the three primaries end up being the kind of basis for the data files and a whole lot of other things. And what's in particular of interest to geeks is crosstalk and separation. Because if there's not a lot of spectral separation, if they, at any particular wavelength in light, you're getting red and green a lot reading, then clearly, for a keying person, that makes a difference, right? You want, like, ideally, pure peaks of separation. Not that you don't expect some crosstalk, and obviously as one colour stops being so dominant in the light spectrum, another is kicking in. Mm-hmm. But we want the response to that to be quite distinct. And so the two that were published by Red was a relative response curve and then a normalized version. And so the normalized version is one that most people would pay attention to. And it just normalizing simply means that it's turned it from being, you know, the blue relative to the red to just being, you know, maximum red, maximum green, maximum blue. And that's a kind of normal thing to look at. So what we were expecting, and I say we, I mean right down to John Galt, who was talking about it at a discussion he was having about the Genesis, he hypothesized what the Mysterium would look like. So John, being a bright guy, just didn't have access to this, didn't know what it looked like, and he hypothesized that there'd be a lot more crosstalk going on between the green and the red, which would mean that it would be harder to get a clean green signal. Now, don't forget, this is the raw response of the sensor and not what you get when you apply matrixing to it. The whole point of matrixing is actually to do a bit of crosstalk multiplying and mixing the colours in so you can get really good saturation.
Now, defining crosstalk, I'm saying, so theoretically that's that the blue channel is really only sensitive to blue light and it's not getting any luminance values out of any other part of the spectrum.
Yeah, like blue reads cleanly, green reads cleanly, red reads cleanly, and it's not muddied up. And if you actually look at the film one that we'll post, you'll actually see what's going on with the magenta in the case of film. Magenta in the green is that magenta never drops away. So let me explain how that is sort of significant to a practical level. Like, you can just look at these things and go, oh, cool, I can see that the number crosses at, you know, on the Genesis at like 70 between the red and the green, and I'll go over to the normalized version of the Mysterium and see that it's crossing closer at 0.5 or 50, depending which way you look at it. And you'd be like, oh, well, gosh, I guess that 0.5 is better than 0.7 or, you know. But this isn't really what we're talking about. What we're talking about is that, for example, if I saturate the sensor with green and I get a good green screen that's with a sensible point,
yeah,
I can now actually look at this graph and tell you that the wavelength that the Genesis likes for green screen, the light, the color green, is kicking in at 535, if you look at the Mysterium, it's kicking in also at around 5.35. Mm-hmm. And so I'm saying that the peak point for the green is like the same between the sensors. And then I can tell you that at that point, there's almost no blue or red component that's kicking in. And then I've got some sense of how much I can deviate from that before we start getting large amounts of red or blue. And thus, I get less separation, less I can produce a less green screen. And in the case of film, you'll notice that there's quite a lot of stuff that's happening with the green. It doesn't, you know, drop away like it does on an electronic sensor. And what this means is if you supersaturate film, you actually, as you start increasing intensity of the green and just making it full on, you actually get more crosstalk, not less. You actually sort of like start having major red components into your green screen separation. And doesn't work very well, which is why you don't supersaturate your greens on a green screen. In fact, you quite often have on a film green screen and stop under on the green. And this is why on the Mysterium, that's not the case, because we've got the separation that we expect. We've got a sensible set of curves that we expect. And it also, I guess, points out why like a dark blue screen isn't going to work as well. I mean, for a start, you're going to get red small levels in there. But that's probably less something that I'm going to read off the spectral response curve. And the choice between blue and green is something more I'd be interested in terms of the natural gamut of the sensor, which is a diagram we're not looking at here. So this isn't proving that I should be doing green or blue. That curve that people have asked for hasn't been, I don't think, published, which shows, you know, exactly how the color space is mapped relative to, say, REC 709 or red space. But that's a, you know, why I choose green over blue picture. This one is basically saying that getting a really strong green signal that's quite narrow in its wavelength is going to give you a really, really great degree of separation. Now, what does that mean for practical terms? It means you don't want to have a green screen on set that's wildly lit between darks and lights, that's wildly lit between, you know, dodgy brothers green and good green. But hey, we knew that, right? But this is sort of looking at this curve tells me as a technical guy quite a lot about why I want a particular type of green screen, why I want it to be evenly lit, and why I want it to not be just green cloth that I happen to get from the, you know, shop down the road, which might have a lot of red in it, and be actually looking green to my eye, but sitting up at, you know, I don't know, 59 or 590. You know, because that's where I'm going to start getting into trouble. If I started thinking that I was walking on set with stuff that was like up at 590, it still looks green to my eye. It has a huge amount of red in it. And if someone's standing in front of it with skin, that's, you know, soft, light-coloured skin, then, I'm not going to get the separation that I would want.
Right. Now, when I look, so I'm looking at the Mysterium curve, and I look at the film curve, it looks quite similar in terms of how separated the green. The green looks quite well separated there. When I'm looking at the Genesis, there's a lot of red and green crossover on the Genesis curve.
The red comes in really quickly, sharply on the Genesis. On the film, you should see there's a bit of latency of green.
A bit of a foot to it.
Yeah, big foot, right? I mean, actually dramatically. And also notice how the blue is hanging in way up into above the 650 range. Versus, say, in the Mysterium, where it's way lower.
Very interesting.
So, but I mean, look, do you need to know these things? Well, no, you don't. You don't have to study these things. But it's good, though, to have the data, because if you're going to want to think about setting up for complicated shoots with complicated green screen, like, for example, a fully digital set where it's worth getting it right because it's a completely virtual environment, then you'd want to have some idea of the separation of the green and the red. You'd want to know if there are any surprises there. And in fact, you know, probably the best way to describe this is the kind of ideal curves we were hoping that the Mysterium had. And, you know, wow, great. But then it's more like tick the box that I didn't get a surprise than tick the box that I learned something dramatically different.
So what is the difference between Mysterium and the Genesis telling you in terms of what, which is there anyone looking like it's better for green screen or worse for green screen?
It's not so much that. It's actually it was hypothesized that the Mysterium wouldn't go this well. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And in fairness, someone like John Gott, when he suggested that, he didn't know. He just didn't have the data, right? So
How is this comparing to like the red one curves?
This is the red one. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you mean the Dulce?
No. It's okay.
Because the Dulce has a really high crossover point on the green and the red. They also published that. We'll include that one in the notes. But you'd sort of expect that because the Dulce sensor is sort of like an older technology. Though, be careful because I don't believe that it's not a spectral response curve that's been normalized. So don't get a heart attack when you look at the blue curve on the Dulce. And normalizing a curve, as I said before, is a completely standard thing to do. It's not a cheat. It's just literally saying between, you know, nothing and everything, let's just draw them equally. And we normalize things all the time. It's a completely sensible mathematical thing to do.
So basically, I mean, when one of the arguments has been against red, I suppose, has been that there's more green and blue photosites or pixels than red. Everyone's always been saying that it's too sensitive or not sensitive enough in other areas because of the basic, you know, there's more pixels in one channel than another. But when you look at these curves, it looks like it's pretty even.
Yeah, I mean, that's a misleading argument because at best what having a Bayer pattern would mean is that the accuracy of the chrominance nature of the picture is not as strong as it should be. Because obviously it's sampling luminance at every point across the chip. It just happens to sample luminance at every point across the chip, and then every second, you know, photosite is either a red or a blue or a green. And so it's not like it's not registering a value there. It's just registering a value, and it happens to be one of the three colors, and then it tries to solve the puzzle of what's missing.
Yeah.
And so, as I've said a few times in the past, if you took a picture and could just blur the color but leave the luminance alone, you need to blur it a hell of a lot before you even notice the difference. If you touch the luminance and leave the chrominance where it is, the second you touch it, it looks soft. And so this is a completely sensible way, which is why, you know, all the companies that make, like the Arri, make a CMOS chip that uses a Bayer pattern, and it's a completely sensible way to go.
Yeah,
but this isn't going to tell me, this response curve isn't going to, this, what this would tell me is if I had really not well-made dies on the chip, if the Mysterium itself wasn't well manufactured, then the purity of the little color that they make for each photosite, the green color versus the red versus the green, if they weren't very pure and well made, then this would show up.
Yeah,
but it wouldn't show up the accuracy of the resolution of color. Not that I'm obsessed by that, because I just don't think it is that critical.
Yeah,
and secondly, it doesn't show up how well the colors that it covers maps to, say, Rec 709 or to Red Space. They're different diagrams. But I just want to applaud Red for actually publishing these because, A, they're good, but B, it's more like there was kind of rumors going around that Red didn't have such good responses, and so obviously Red said, look, just to quell it, let's publish it. So this is something that I say would, you know, be a bit like saying, you know, I'm not an axe murderer. Well, good. I'm glad you're not an axe murderer.
I'll prove it. Here's my police record.
Yeah, but, you know, it's not like you... It's not as startling as if somebody came out and said, oh, look, I am an axe murderer. So,
okay.
Moving on.
Interesting analogy. Right.
Geek out session over. Feel free to take finger off fast forward button. I get to play another theme tune now. I get to play our geek guide.
And now, the Red Setter Gear Guide.
It's not quite as smooth when we sort of, you know...
Well, it's the first time I got to play them.
Okay. Next time we'll just play them. Okay, so just a little prequel to our discussion on heads. This first one with Bob Lowe from O'Connor US is slightly longer because what we wanted to do is sort of lay down some of the ground rules or some of the key sort of theories and in head choice and counterbalance and weight ratings and things like that. So the other thing I wanted to point out is
Can you help me with this? Because the thing about this interview is I found it really interesting, but I don't know them as well as you do. Yep. And there seem to be a lot of numbers.
Okay.
Can you give me like the 2-second guide to numbers to listen out to?
Yep. Okay. Well, primarily we're really talking about just three heads, and the numbers actually go up. It's
now,
quite
three
simple.
Three heads the numbers being the go bit up. On top of the tripod, not the tripod legs themselves.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep.
They're called legs.
No, okay, but I'm just making clear. So the heads have their own serial number, right?
Yes, basically, rather than giving it a name like Arrow 55 or something.
Okay, so I've got three.
There's two ranges, 100 millimeter bowl and 150 millimeter bowl. So that's basically the diameter of the leveling bowl base. Okay.
So 100 would be the minimum, 150 is kind of the standard.
Yeah. So the three heads we'll be talking about in the interview is the 1030, which is a 100 millimeter bowl.
1030, got it, yeah.
1030, the 2060, and the 2575.
So anything with a 20 at the front is the bigger version.
It is.
And then what are the numbers at the end? 20 what?
Sort of go with their ratings, whether they're going for like 60 pounds or 75 pounds or so, but it's not quite right. There's no exact science. But just know that as the numbers go higher, the heads go up the food chain.
Okay, basically. And what are those two numbers again?
The 2060 and the 2575.
2575, okay. All right, got it. Well, I'll write those down on a piece of paper and I'll be able to follow along.
Okay.
I know that you know this stuff intrinsically, that it's born into your DNA, and I know that I don't. But that's fine. I'm willing to admit that.
Okay. So here's Bob from O'Connor. Okay, I'm speaking to Key Accounts Manager for O'Connor, Bob Lowe. Thanks for speaking to us today, Bob.
It's my pleasure.
Look, take us through the O'Connor story, because it had a really interesting start, didn't it?
Yes, Mr. O'Connor, back in the late 40s, 1948 or 49, was very interested in steam locomotives and would record different vintage steam locomotives before they were retired, record them on 16-millimeter film. When a gentleman came up behind him and tapped him on the shoulder and asked him what it was he had underneath his 60-millimeter camera, Mr. O'Connor turned and explained that he had developed this fluid head that helped him make smooth pans as the trains were entering the station. And the gentleman said, "Could you make me one?" And Mr. O'Connor's answer to that was, "No, this is just a hobby of mine. I'm not really in this business." And the gentleman then said, "Could you make me about 10 of them?" And Mr. O'Connor, at that point, thought, "Well, maybe I could make a business out of this." And it turns out that the gentleman he was speaking to was Walt Disney. And from that point on, Disney used only O'Connor heads.
Great start. What do you think separates O'Connor from other manufacturers?
Well, I think the main thing is quality and workmanship. The materials are, for the most part, magnesium and high-grade aluminum, very much like aerospace, and very close tolerance machining, which the end result is a very precision product. Also, the features of the O'Connor having an infinitely variable counterbalance system and also infinitely variable fluid drag, both those features, I think, separate them from a lot of the competition that's out there.
Let's explain, if you can, the weight rating system, which basically all tripods, I guess, are based on.
Well, the rating systems are always, no matter from what manufacturer you're talking about, are for counterbalance. And when you ask the question, well, what is that head rated for, you'll very seldom get an answer, a very precise answer, well, that head's rated for 29.5 pounds. The answer you'll get is more like, well, it's around 30 pounds, 31 pounds, because the rate, the counterbalance is a combination of weight and vertical center of gravity. And the fluid head, the taller the camera is, the heavier it feels on tilt. So vertical CG or vertical center of gravity is as important as the weight rating. So it's a combination of both.
Yeah, because I guess any tripod can hold the camera up off the ground. It's how it feels when you start moving it around.
And if a head is, say, rated for 30 pounds and you have 50 pounds on that head, the head isn't in danger of being damaged or being broken. It's just that head won't counterbalance the way it was intended. But it's still a safe situation. It's just not going to counterbalance precisely.
So obviously there's horses for courses on these sorts of things. People using the red one are going to be doing anything from docos right through to full feature work. So I'll start at one end of town. What do we think is maybe the more lightweight solutions from O'Connor?
Well, I would think for a one-man operation and in a lighter configuration of the Red 1, that the 1030 HDS is probably the best fluid head for that operation. And then on a, let's say, 100-millimeter base with a carbon fiber tripod, O'Connor makes a 25L, which is a very lightweight two-stage 100-millimeter tripod, all carbon fiber, that works well with the 1030 HDS.
So, yeah, 100-mil bowl is probably okay, providing you've got a solid head with great counterbalance on it.
Right. Again, in going up the next step above 100 millimeters, 150-millimeter gets quite a bit more substantial and probably a little bit much for a one-man operation or a run-and-gun situation. You'd probably want an assistant once you go up to 150-millimeter ball. The next one up for O'Connor would be the 2060, and that one would be recommended with a 150-millimeter ball and a medium-duty tripod. Again, probably in that situation, we recommend that the head and legs travel separately, not together in a single tube like the 1030 could. So minimum you would have two cases to carry with a 2060 system. Probably put a 2060 over your shoulder while it's still on the tripod, but you definitely don't want to ship it air freight or even carry on as luggage with the head on the legs. You would want to, as the head comes down the baggage ramp and hits feet first, that shock just travels up and it would go right into the head. So you really do want them to travel in separate cases.
So what would be the advantages from going from, say, the 1030, the 100-mil bowl, going to, say, the 2060, which is the 150, is, I guess, the entry-level 150-mil bowl?
The main feature would be the weight carrying capacity or the ability to counterbalance. The 2060 and with a 6-inch center of gravity on the camera, which is where O'Connor rates their heads, the 2060 holds 65 pounds or 29.5 kgs at a 6-inch center of gravity. The 1030 HDS is 41 pounds or 18.6 kg with that same six inch center of gravity. We've measured the Red 1 in its standard configuration is about a 6-inch CG. As you add things above that, of course, the CG goes up, and you can actually add things below that, and the CG goes down. So, again, that's just kind of a rule of thumb. But the Red 1 is very close to a 6-inch vertical CG.
Now, I've used the 2060 with Red 1 and sort of reasonably optioned up. Not a massively big zoom, but with, you know, Cook S4 primes, and I think it handles really well.
Yes, I agree. It's quite a capable head, very much just the little brother to the 2575. Appearance-wise, feature-wise, almost identical to a 2575, just has a slightly lower counterbalance capacity.
So one of the main gains from going from the smaller 1030 to the 2060 is the fantastic counterbalance crank.
Yes. Yeah, that is kind of a mark or a feature, a very visible feature of O'Connor. And it really does make counterbalance theory and technology very apparent. That crank, when you dial it in, makes it very visible what you're doing as far as counterbalancing, just cranking up the counterbalance spring or cranking it down with it with a digital readout to let you know where you are. If you use the same camera package, if you're using the same Red 1 with the same lens, with the same battery, all you would just have to note where you were the last time you used that. On any head, it could have been your 2060 or a rented 2060, you just crank in back to that same number say the last time you balanced it was at 53. If you use that same counterbalance or that same camera again, you just crank that head back to 53 and you would be perfectly counterbalanced.
It's a fantastic setup. As you say, it is one of your it's your key.
It's kind of our claim to fame or our identity. It's that counterbalance crank.
You touched on it before, the 2575. That really is, I think, the gold standard for heads, I think.
Right. Feature film production has standardized on the 2575C, whether it's Panavision cameras or Aeroflex cameras. They seem to have standardized on that fluid head many years ago. 2575C came into existence about 14 years ago, and in Panavision headquarters here in Woodland Hills in California owns 350 of them, and it seems that every camera package that goes out of Panavision goes with a 2575 and a geared head, so the packages go out with both heads.
Clearly, when we're stepping up from 2060 to 2575, there's a significant weight increase in the whole rig.
Right. Yeah. The 2575C weighs 22.9 pounds, and a 2060 weighs 16 pounds. That's head only weight.
Yeah. So that's 10 kilos
and 7.3 kilos.
7.3. Right. Okay. Even with a red one, with a say a 10-to-1 zoom and microforces and a 6.6 Mapox and a few bits of glass up the front, you could easily get into 2575 territory.
Absolutely, yeah. The it really does depend on how you configure the camera.
Now, technically, are you gaining anything from 2060 to 2575? Is there any big bonuses there?
No, feature-wise, they are the same. I think the one thing you gain with the 2575 is the familiarity of the DPs are already familiar with the 2575, and in some cases not familiar with the 2060, even though feature-wise they're the same. Well, then you also get the extra what we call headroom or weight capacity of the 2575, so you have less concern about maxing out when you're using the big lenses.
You can't underestimate the importance of having great counterbalance, can we?
No, you can't. And it is a theory that's very important to understand. And when it's properly done, it really can improve a cameraman's ability to shoot very steady, smooth, make very steady and smooth movements. A properly counterbalanced fluid head, when you can tilt to any position, take your hand off the handle, and the camera will stay exactly where you leave it. Not that you want to do that in the middle of a move, but that is what a properly counterbalanced fluid head will do. So you're not fighting any of the weight of the camera. You're allowing the fluid to do its job at that point.
No, I mean, I guess that is a good test of a good setup. Not that you want to take your hands off an unlocked head for very long, but taking your hands off slightly is a great check that you have the right sort of counterbalance.
Right. Actually, in theory, and if it's properly counterbalanced, you could just walk away from the camera and it would stay there. But you want to make absolutely certain you are perfectly counterbalanced. When you take your hand off the handle, the camera doesn't move at all.
Yeah.
The fluid head doesn't move at all, not even a millimeter down or up. It just stays exactly where you leave it.
The basis of that concept is that you want all the subtleties of the input of the operator to come through to the lens and not be affected by weight forward or weight back. You want
exactly
the operator wants to know that his every little subtle move comes through to the lens.
Right. That's a very important concept to understand. And it's a concept that does get missed in some instances.
Now, with all of the 150s, and I guess to some degree in the 100mm bowls. We talk about bowls, but we do have options on the bottom of these heads.
Right. That's another advantage of O'Connor is that there are base options and platform options, but as far as a base option, it's very easy to switch out from one base to another. So you could go from a 150mm ball to a Mitchell base very easily, very quickly, just by removing four Allen screws and swapping base and putting those same four screws back in.
Most of the stuff I see, just I guess because rental companies want to make this thing adaptable, I'm mostly starting to see bowls coming out rather than the Moy flat base or the Mitchell base.
Right. It, you know, that's kind of a regional thing. We see almost exclusively 150 millimeter ball bases in Europe and just the reverse in the U.S. If it's film style shooting in the U.S., it's generally Mitchell base.
The flat base, obviously, the flat base, you are losing the ability to quickly level the head.
Right. And when you're shooting off of a dolly, sometimes the thought is if you have a Mitchell base, you eliminate the possibility of being out of level with the ball base. If the dolly's level and you use a Mitchell base, then the Mitchell base is pretty much automatically level there.
Yeah, I guess if you're going straight to onto the dolly, you know that's one less step, I guess, bolted
exactly.
On and your level.
And then the thought also in the U.S. is anything over about 75 or 80 pound camera package, you want Mitchell. And that's simply if an assistant comes and thinks he's going to level the head, unlocks the tie down, which unlocks the leveling system, and you have over 80 pounds on there, that's a bit much for one guy once it slips.
Yeah.
And he has to catch it. So Mitchell is a little safer when you're using heavier camera packages.
Now on to tripods. If you're a more one guy run and gun thing, you probably want to go with more two stage. And then when you go into the serious film side of things, then obviously you start to go into high legs and low legs.
That again, I think is somewhat tied to weight. A single stage tripod is always rated higher weight carrying capacity than its same size two-stage tripod. Simply, it just has one less set of leg locks, so the weight capacity is would be higher on a single stage than it is on a two-stage.
Okay, so take us through what O'Connor does for us then in those two.
We in 100 millimeter, O'Connor has a two-stage 25L, which is all carbon fiber. And a single stage tripod, which would be a quick setup, 100 millimeter, is the 35L. As we move up into more the film style shooting, we have a Cine HD tripod, which is a single stage heavy duty tripod that's available either with Mitchell top or 150 millimeter top.
Right.
We're also available with a ground spreader or a mid-level spreader. And in this case, ground spreaders are, in film style are much more popular than the mid-level.
Okay. Anything we should know about accessories-wise, do you think?
Well, again, O'Connor, with their film background, has readily available things like front box mounts and eyepiece levelers to very popular accessories, and also we also have interchangeable handles, different diameter handles, and what's become quite popular recently is actually a front handle. So the heads do have a front rosette that uh-huh. allows you to attach a handle. Say if you're right-handed, with your right hand on the pan and tilt, then your left hand would be on the forward handle, and it gives you a lot of control that way over the fluid head.
Thank you, Bob. By being the first cab off the rank on our sort of roundup of tripods, you've had to be the one to lay the groundwork and a lot of the theories and practices.
Well, I thank you. I do appreciate the opportunity, and I'd also like to thank Red and all the Red users that have been such a big point for O'Connor over the last couple of years. The O'Connor Red relationship has been a very, very nice relationship, and it has really been a breath of fresh air to a 50-year-old company that has seen record sales in 2007 and 2008 due to the support of the Red community.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you, mate.
Thanks. Thank you.
That's great, Jason. I love that story about Walt Disney. I mean, yeah, how cool is that? It's like, I want to be tapped on the shoulder. Excuse me, Mike, what are you compositing there? Well,
I'm going to pay you to do something different to what you normally do.
And the number of heads and tripods that Panavision is like 300 or something. It was astonishing. Hey, what else is out there in the new Red universe?
Okay, well, Element Technica in their infinite wisdom.
Because we love Element Technica anymore.
Absolutely. Beautifully, beautifully made gear. They've just announced a couple more pieces of kit. The Qi Stick and the EVF mount. Now, EVF mount, I think it's fantastic. I'll get to that in a sec. The Qi Stick basically is a top
Qi Stick.
is a top handle for to go. I guess it bolts into the top of the cheese plate. So you need to have the cheese plate to mount to it. Basically, it's a nice top handle. Plenty of Element Technica are all about having plenty of screw points and threaded holes everywhere, all over the place, if you want to put spuds for mounting lights or monitors or brackets or anything. Basically, it's a top grab handle. It also has holes at either end for putting rods in, 15 or 19 mil rods. There's not two versions of this. Basically, they just give you little bushes to let you put either size rods in. But basically, you can put those out the front of the camera if you're going to mount like a servo motor off that for remote focus or iris, or if you want to stick something out the back and mount a bracket or whatever you like off the back of the camera. So that is $450 US, and you can order that now from elementtechnica.com. And the other one is the EVF mount, which is basically essentially an eyepiece extension or a viewfinder extension.
They already had the eyepiece thing.
You have
mounted
to have the EVF mount to use it.
But this extension, can I ask you a question? Is this the thing that means if I tilt the camera down, the eyepiece remains in the same level?
Close to being in the same place. Arm? Exactly right, yep.
Oh, just both, so it's an extension
arm. This is the same as having on a film, having an extension viewfinder on a film camera.
Right,
basically.
So as I tilt up and down, the eyepiece is going to stay pretty much
exactly
where it is.
Exactly right. So what you need to do is, now what isn't mentioned here is what you use to level it. Normally what you would do is extend the viewfinder out with this bracket, but then also you'll need another piece of equipment called the eyepiece leveler or the EPL, and that will mount from the viewfinder down to the tripod head. So basically, essentially, if you tilt up, obviously, normally, if you tilt up, you'd have to move your head and your whole body with the camera as it's tilting. But this will keep the viewfinder in a similar place in space. But you will need to try and find a EPL, and basically Ari and a few other people, and also O'Connor, who we just mentioned, will make these for you as well.
Okay, but so... So I'm clocking it at about, what, $1,200 for
it's
the
It's definitely
original
all adding up.
EVF mount, the original one, is like a $1,200. And then there's what? Yep. What do I have to put on? So that plus what?
So to extend your viewfinder out, you'll need the Element Technica, the EVF mount, which is $1,190 US. Then you'll need the, if you want to extend it, then the EVF mount extension was another $450 US.
And then still need that extra rod, right?
Yeah, you need the eyepiece leveler, which I'm not sure of pricing. That's an O'Connor or plenty of other.
That would probably be less expensive
probably
than
Satchler
that.
Satchler as well will make those. Yeah, that'll be considerably. Well, I'm not sure of the pricing, I'm sorry. But definitely, you can extend your viewfinder without having this adjustment, but it's just a really nice thing to have the EPL to.
Well, you've been saying that for a while, actually, that you like.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Oh, look, that's definitely one thing that's it's one of those things that once you've had this sort of thing, particularly if you run the camera quite low, it's nice to get the viewfinder up to your eye. And if you're doing sort of wild tilts or interesting operations or just extreme angles, it's really nice to not have to get your operator or yourself to do these amazing sort of contortions. So that is a couple of fantastic, very nicely made pieces of kit. Get your wallets out for that stuff, though.
What do you like having on set? What do you? Because I bought a Miller, so I use it.
Yeah, Look, I mean, I don't do an awful lot of operating myself, but I'm a big fan of the 2575, the big head. But lately, the 2060, I've been seeing the 2060 on set a few times, and they're both really nice. I just like really nice sort of solid feeling head that when you sort of grab it, because you know sometimes I'm sort of walk away. Typical director, just walk up and unlock it and go, oh yeah, great. How about over here? And then just walk away and sort of forget to lock the head. So well, I have a nice solid thing there that's not going to...
But in fairness, after last week's podcast, you played with our Miller and it was better than you thought it was, right?
It was actually. It's a 100mm bowl. It's quite a... I don't even know what tripod that is actually.
It's the 55.
It is, yeah. And obviously since then I've been and recorded an interview with Miller for next episode. And yeah, I was actually pretty impressed that it is a viable alternative. So
you don't care on set because you just work with... Do you just work with the same grip? I mean, how many grips do you kind of availability?
You know, the grip and the gaffer selection, to be honest, most of that I do leave to... I mean, I do care who's on set. But that decision I do leave to my DP of choice.
So back in the day, when I was way back in the day, I mean, like, you know, we're talking before the internet, I think. Anyway, when I was working in a production company and I used to watch and the producer would come out and the first thing she'd ask the director is what DOP you wanted to work with. And you'd get a list of three. Like, I'd prefer to work with so-and-so, but if he's not available, we'll try so-and-so, because that was based on the, you know, if you're shooting kids or cars.
Yeah, based on how good their reel is, and more often you need to be able to send that reel sometimes to the agency.
I was going
to
say, because sometimes the agency were really fussy. Or like Elle Macpherson, you know, likes working with particular DOPs because...
Yeah.
And if she wants that and she's this talent, then you just do that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then... They would say, ask them if they have anyone they want to work with.
We'd give them a list of availabilities from the agencies and they'd sort of choose from there, basically.
You'd nearly always know your grip and gaffer.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely would know the guys from before. And, I think, obviously, you want guys that are really going to, you know, lift their game and not sort of sit on an Apple box and make phone calls about the next job all the time. But more than that, I actually want people... I really like to run a very relaxed, a very comfortable, happy, friendly shoot. I like to...
Yeah, but I've been on your shoots, and they're comfortable and happy, but that's because everybody is completely focused and just totally concentrating.
Yeah, I think it's...
Not because they're terrified of you, but just because, you know, this is like a proper, decent, good quality crew.
Yeah, I think obviously, yeah, absolutely, you get to a certain level and everyone has that sort of professionalism. They're going to walk on set with that. Otherwise, you just don't, you know, you don't really get to walk on again.
Yeah.
But I just like that nice balance of professionalism, getting on with it, but also I want to walk away.
How much
life's
do you want them
short.
To anticipate what you're going to do next? How much do you want them just be paying attention to what's... Because like, the thing I noticed with... Like, say the gaffer, right?
Mm.
I'll come to that grip in a second. But like the gaffer like lights something, and then they keep one ear open when you start getting the performance, you want to change something. But to a certain extent, like once you're into the... They're just kind of monitoring and hovering around in the back.
I think, once we sort of get shooting, I will probably be in conversation with the grip. I know it sounds really weird, but I'll probably... Maybe it's because of my background. Maybe other directors do this. I don't know. But I would... Because sometimes the timing of the dolly and where you sort of... When you track really affects the sort of whole shot and the timing of the shot and the psychology of it. I would actually, you know, tell them to, you know, don't go on action, go on and, or give it a long and, you know, just hold off on the dolly or just pick it up a bit faster at the end. And sort of, I would actually probably
just translate, giving it a long and.
Sorry.
Is...
If you go and action.
Yes.
So
at the end of action.
If you're trying to get the camera moving before your
you
cut
go
point,
on and then action.
Yeah, you go
I,
on
I know
and.
That's universal. I know
sorry.
That it's, I know it's the case here, right?
Yeah.
And action. I use that myself.
Yeah. Or you go and action.
Yeah.
But
do you do second actions?
We probably would do background action and action.
Or you
might
yourself,
also...
or do you get your first?
I got my first to do it.
Right. So you're sitting over at the video split?
Yeah, because sometimes I don't really want to have to... If I start getting involved in the timing, if it's like, you know, you've got a background action, you've got foreground actors, then you've got a dolly or and some other sort of people crossing. And people, you know, extras crossing in the foreground or whatever. If I start getting in there and say, now these guys need to go later, I'll often... It's like sort of doing something in the mirror. You kind of... I might say you go later when actually they should have gone earlier. You know what I mean? So I think I'll leave all the queuing.
I think the thing that you notice on a really well-run set is that nobody over-volunteers. Like, in other words,
yes.
Nobody goes, oh, I see what you're after, so I'll change what I'm doing. Because once you do that, you have moving targets.
Exactly.
You kind of need everybody to just take a breath and stay where you are, and then I'll fix the thing that isn't working, but not everybody else re-time to accommodate the person that isn't meeting their mark.
Exactly. If everyone's sort of changing their cue, then it's too many things.
Target.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's like if you're shooting like car to car, like from one car to another car, you don't want the hero car to start doing things. The camera car is the one that has to be the one that makes those changes, and you know everyone else keep constant. But a lot of it is really run by the first AD. You know,
it's funny you say that, because I always thought you were about to say the DOP. Because I always think the DOP is the head of the shoot. I mean, not the creative head, but just, you know, the crew looks to the DOP.
I suppose they're the head of... I suppose in a way you can kind of split it down the middle that a lot of the, you know, art department and hair and makeup and things are not so much revolving around the on-camera side. I know, obviously, I know it's all on camera, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
That's all sort of controlled by a first AD, but sort of lighting and lighting cues and dollies and when they all move would be that sort of stuff, and the rigging would be more come from the DP.
I've done some first ADing, and I guess the thing about any of those roles is it's astonishing how the second you become a first AD, you can no longer be a VFX supervisor. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I think what you're saying about being a director, right? The second that you start...
That's right.
You can't direct because you can't do those multiple jobs.
Why I don't shoot my stuff anymore, really, because I can just found that just being a typical man, I just can't multitask. If I'm looking at exposure or sun going in and out or sharps or whatever, I know that some way, subconsciously, if I'm using 10% of my brain to do that, I'm definitely going to be 10% not doing it on the...
I'm firsting on this green screen shoot, and all that is actor in front of green screen, right? Like, they have to run through a shot and stuff, because we're producing, like... But it's, you know, because we're second unit, so... I love second unit. Second unit is where...
Absolutely.
I once had a shoot where I was down and we were shooting this huge Rexona thing. It was like athletes, triathletes, and it was running through hell and back, right, was the gag. And they were like, first unit was all on the principal actors, which were really well-known Olympians, right? And they said, well, we've got to get all these explosions and, you know, sort of geysery kind of shooting up in the air things happening over here and stuff, and we're running a bit late. And the first on that one turned to me and said, oh, Mike, you can do it. Why don't you do second unit direct? And they just turned and said to the special effects guys, hey, you're all with Mike.
Yeah,
go
bye.
Over to the quarry and just shoot this afternoon stuff.
Yeah.
And I've never been happier. I mean, I literally like flame gel. And they were like, they'd been there for 2 days, hadn't done much, kind of bored, right? And I'm like, and they're like, do you want us to set some mortars off? I'm like, oh, yeah, definitely want mortars. And they're like, what else have you got? Well, we've got this that we've been wanting to play with. Oh, I need some of that.
Second unit on those effects things. They can
so much fun. But what I was going to say about being a first, when I was a first, I had this green screen shot. All I had this guy run through frame because it was second unit. I wasn't directing, but I was second unit VFX. And they said, why don't you first AD it as well? Because you know what you want.
Mm.
I get 8 guys running through shot. Only then do I actually notice that somebody's put a water bottle down in front of the green screen. It's been there in the middle of frame for every take. And I'm the guy who's meant to be supervising. And do you think I noticed it? Not once. I was first ADing, making sure they were changing costume. Let's keep it moving, people. Mm. Need to get through these shots. Just didn't even notice it. I was like, right. So I think actually that's a point. I know on an independent film you don't have that luxury, but on a proper big production, you know, doing multiple jobs, God knows how an actor acts and directs.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that obviously this, I think one of the main choices there would be is that they would choose you'd have to choose a DOP that in some way is a DP director, or has got a director's hat on, that can almost say, "Look, this is the scene. This is what I want to convey. This is the beats that I really want to hit," and let the cameraman come up with a lot of the coverage and the angles, and obviously in consult with yourself. But I think you'd have to let those guys would have to be running with directors that with DPs that also would have directing skills.
You know what
it's
like when you're dressing, you have to dress the camera.
Mm.
Like you can be 2 feet off to the side and think it looks dorky, and then when you actually look through, flower looks just right,
looks
even
fine.
Though it looks odd on set on three apple boxes with a C stand holding it.
Yeah,
it looks great in the. And so, how the hell do you do that when you're on the other side, 180 degrees around? I just don't know.
You'd have to, as I say, you'd have to be almost your DP would have to be, you know, the other half of your brain for sure.
I must say, I think with Grips, what I like, what I can't help but like, what any boy, and I don't want to be sexist, but any boy just loves is. Where do they get those fabulous toys out of the van? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, they come out with a panther.
I just love it.
Put a panther down, and they start bringing this arm thing, and this seat goes out here, and this turns... Oh, my God,
and
those
the,
things are just
the gear is just getting so much more interesting, and everything's gyro-stabilized, and all the cranes are all gyro-stabilized, and it's just... Yeah, it's just... Oh, love it.
I mean, the thing about it is, because nobody wants their rig broken into, right, a good grip truck looks like a crappy moving van from the outside.
Well, it looks like a very nice moving van, but...
No, they don't normally look like pristine and mega expensive.
Some of them do. There's a fantastic grips guy in Jeff Full who has a huge grip company. He's probably the biggest gripping company in one of the...
Matrix Star
big
Wars
toys,
gripping.
Big Toys, I'm sure it's called. Big Toys.
Yeah, Big Toys.
.com.au probably. It's just the massive trucks, and it's just
That's Pantech,
gorgeous
huge bloody thing.
Yeah.
No, I mean like a grip truck on a commercial, right?
Yeah.
Which is to say, because like anything, right? Like you, like imagine that you're an armorer and you put on the side, you know, Bob's Armory. I mean, your truck would be nicked in about a section, right?
Yes, they're always very white and very plain. They don't have anything written on them too much. It's not.
But when they open up, it's a labyrinth cave, and you go inside the grip truck, and it's like. I don't know. They must just spend the whole weekend taking everything out of their truck and working out a cleverer way to restack it to save one extra mil.
Yeah. Oh, they're put together like a Swiss watch. Like, this must go in before this. You must load that before that. Otherwise, you can't sort of...
Do you get the truck at a standard fee? Or is it like Grips, a gaffer's where, like, there's a barcode practically, but as you virtually walk out with every light, it ka-chinks?
Yeah, exactly. You've got everything on set. But at least this is the Australian system, which is, I think, UK do is slightly different.
Or do you buy the truck?
You'll get the truck. If you just get the gaffer to turn up and not take anything out and walk away, you'll just pay for truck, you know, $500 or $800 or whatever it is.
But if you get out
of
Panther...
Yeah, you get out, pay, you know that you've got everything there you could possibly need and pay for what you use. Basically, if you want another length of track, you get charged per length of track, and which is great to know that everything's there. You don't have to sort of pre-decide what lights or what gear or what sort of heads what you need before you need it.
You guys, you got to back me up on this because I'm about to say to Jace, I think if the guys are into it and they send in, I know it's not specifically Red, we should get a grip in someday, because I just always wanted to know what they do with that big round knob at the back of the thing that seems to charge up the hydraulics or something.
It's very easy. Yep. No, we should definitely get a grip in to have a chat, because
if you guys are interested in that, send us an email. I love on set stuff. I love the quality of the work, but also certainly for an Australian crew, that I mean, the grips are quite often some of the most reliable,
absolutely,
and foul-mouthed individuals you'll ever meet in your entire life. I mean, they are. They're the ones telling the worst sick jokes on
absolutely.
Set.
Absolutely. But no, I think that the gripping industry, and this is obviously the same for gaffers and electrics in Australia, not that it's not in the other part, in other regions, but it's like this last great sort of team sport thing. Part of the Australian... ethics, and I think that's why a lot of Australian sort of lead crew are so in demand and so popular around the world, is that there's just this mentality of just let's just get on with it. I'm not going to sit here and have a meeting about it. Well, the best way to do it is let's just muck in and do it. And there's no kind of, we're not too big on the union thing. We're not too big on the whole demarcation. It's just like muck in and let's get it done.
Yeah, I actually am pro organized labor because I actually think that some of the things on set I'd actually prefer to see in post. Like there's a 10-hour turnaround.
Of course.
And I would love that to be in post. I would love in post if you had a 10-hour turnaround. You couldn't finish the shot at 2 a.m. and then be on the seat again at 8.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you talk to, a lot of the guys, as you know, like David Strippin, this is, he's doing 7 days on Avatar. It's just crazy.
And I no disrespect to anyone that's doing that, but like the on-set guys are really good at, and also just the whole concept of overtime, right? Stopping people from just going for forever by saying,
oh, definitely. I've nearly killed myself by not having 10-hour turnarounds. There's a lot of crew around because of the 10-hour turnaround. I had to finish at the Blue Mountains at 10 o'clock at night and be on Palm Beach at 5 o'clock in the morning the next day. And, yeah, I fell asleep at the wheel and lucky to be here. It's there's a lot of stuff like that. That's definitely, I'm glad that's around.
I guess, it's easy for the more traditional crafts to not get the kind of attention that the new digital whiz-bang stuff gets. But as you said, those guys are really pushing the boundaries of what they can come up with. And we sort of arrogantly think that we're doing all the cool stuff. But those guys are really constantly looking for new and better ways to grip a camera.
Oh, there's a fantastic grip here in Sydney called Lester Bishop, and he has his own machine shop and owns CNC machines. And he spends his time when he's not on shoots. Every time I go and work with him, he says, oh, here's a new DVD of this thing we built. He's built this fantastic thing, you know, goes out of the roof of a car and for doing 360-degree shots through sunroofs of cars that you could basically drive the car around and do beauty shots of the car you're shooting from any angle. It's drive and shoot as you go. It's fantastic. So, yeah, those guys sort of, it is big boys toys.
All right. We got to move on, but I don't care. I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, we'll get someone in for sure. Let's do that.
Well, now, moving off from gear to post, as you remember last week, we started our series on looking at boxes that deal with the R3D files, and one of the first that has come out is the Nucoda. And the Nucoda system is just out. I think it's only out for about 2 or 3 weeks. But when I say it's out, it's actually still kind of hard to get your hands on the actual software. So it is available, but if you're going to rent something or do something, you'd really want to check out that its availability was there, because it's not necessarily the case that it is. Nucoda's been going for a while. Unfortunately, I believe I'm right in saying that the company is going through a restructuring right now. And so,
because if I search for Nucoda, I get put through to digitalvision.se.
Well, Digital Vision is, you know, Nucoda. Right. Okay. It's like the mothership.
Right.
It's like Autodesk to Flame.
Okay.
But the, so the bit of a cloud hanging over the company, a real cloud hanging over the company, actually, let's be honest about it. But let's assume they come out of that, and we hope that they do, though I would be less concerned if we weren't going through like an economic crisis. They have a range of products from the Film Master to the Film Cutter. There's a data conform package, and then there's a HD workflow and an SD workflow. These are kind of smaller baby units. They also have a range of restoration stuff like the Phoenix, and there's motion compensation stuff. And most of them, in fact, the motion estimation compensation stuff they make, the DVNRs and DVOs and stuff, are used a lot. I mean, so much so that probably 80% of film programming you actually see on TV has gone through one of their DV processing systems. But the actual color grading stuff is where the red stuff's going.
Yeah, well, because the Nucoda is not, at least in this part of the world, it's not a grading system I've come in contact with. But it doesn't mean it's not widespread in other parts of the world.
No, and they're out of Sweden, and then the products, Film Master and Film Cutter and these ones, they've decided to stick the red functionality into all of them because they think it's a good idea to have conform capabilities and everything else. Fantastic. And I got a chance to talk last week to one of the guys from Nucoda, Simon Cuff. And Simon's actually in London when I speak to him. And I'll cross that interview now, if that's right. So we wanted to talk to you about Nucoda, and in particular, the implementation plans for doing R3D stuff, if that's possible.
Yep. Yep.
You announced some stuff at NAB. Can you just tell us where you're actually up to in terms of getting that out in the marketplace?
We released 3.6 R2 last week, and that contained pretty much all we showed at IBC.
Right.
So that allows you to bring in R3D files, specify the decoding parameters on a per-clip basis, and either grade them natally or transcode them to whatever format you want.
So how does that work with the range of products? Because you have like from Filmmaster to the data conform stuff. I mean, how does it fit in with the range of products?
Yeah, we thought about this, and pretty much as it's obviously we have add value at the conform side as well as on the grading side. We actually thought it actually makes sense to put in all our products. So every single one of our software products has got the same R3D functionality.
And is that R3D functionality coming from the SDK? In other words, just an implementation from the SDK, okay. And so how much control have you got of the decode process of the R3Ds in terms of being able to... You know,
well, pretty much, we're actually obviously aware, regarding the SDK, the SDK agreement specifies we don't talk about details in public about the SDK. That's the kind of the red agreement. But in terms of getting out the images, we can get out full color dynamic range, full bit depth from the R3D file. There's no limitation compared to, say, any other implementation that would be out there.
So what are the files when you are dealing with them in a Filmmaster or a whatever? What is it, like a 14-bit, a 16-bit, 12-bit? What are you actually dealing with?
16-bit. And if you think the sensor's 12-bit, and the sensor's, you know, it's not full 4K, we can decode to 16-bit 4K. And then you've got the full spatial resolution and color resolution that would have come from the original sensor.
Right. And so am I right in thinking that, I think I saw on your website that you thought, or the company was saying, that about 80% of film originated programming seen on TV in prime time has been some way passed through. I mean, I was trying to get a handle on the size of the market in terms of your influence in, especially in Europe and America.
That thing about 80%, that's obviously that includes DVR as well.
Right.
You know, most prime time is run through one of our systems. So basically, almost every single pixel is touched by our software or hardware. In terms of 2007, we had a very, very good year. It's hard to obviously find out figures regarding our competitors, but it's my opinion that units and revenue were pretty much up there at the top. It's very hard to predict exactly where you came up, but you know, we got a lot of systems out there. And we're seeing a lot of people who have chosen other systems coming to us now for the Red support. So Ascent Media in Russia, The Mill in London, and others are coming and putting new code into their digital lab as the commercials market is shifting away from film and looking at cameras like Red and Phantom and things like that.
So traditionally you've had high performance because of extensive look layer stuff on the GPU, isn't that right?
Yeah, we focused on GPU and was also Intel optimized SSE code. So we've focused on using the GPU to the max and then the CPU to the max. So a typical workstation has 8 cores and a GPU, and we'll look to use all that processing power when we're doing image processing.
And so we touched before on the product line, but can you just walk me through the various kit and then the difference between the models, leaving aside the DVNR and DVO stuff and Cypher?
Entry level is data conform, and that is a basic timeline engine which has all our file format support like Red, and you can edit together in multi-track, where you can conform using EDLs, AAF, or cut lists, and then export that conform or that list to another system. It's generally the assist tool in a lot of DI projects. A step up above that is what we call film cutter, and that has a lot more mastering technology. So it's got primary grading, it's got PAM scan, it's got video I/O, it's got compositing and effects. And that's generally either a fully loaded, like a fully blown assist station, or some people are using it on their own right for doing mastering projects. And then top of the line is Film Master, which is 2K, 4K, DI grading, has the control surface and unlimited layers of secondaries. Then what we did about a year ago is there were certain markets where they didn't need 2K and 4K. Typically broadcasters looking to move from SD to HD, and they're looking at a different feature set and price point. So we cut out some of the DI and the 2K and 4K support and focused on MXF and QuickTime grading for HD, and we called that Nucoder HD. So those are kind of the main products. On the restoration side, the software equivalent of DVNR is actually called Phoenix.
Right.
And that's got all our restoration tools, the same algorithms, but they've been improved for software and they work at any resolution.
And then presumably if I wanted to do a RED workflow through, say, Filmmaster or something like Filmmaster, Filmmaster would have the secondaries, right? Then I would bring in the R3D files, and you're saying I could operate them either natively as R3D or I could presumably work what, DPX?
I mean, if you look at the highest level quality, obviously a 4K decode at high quality is, you know, you're not going to get much more than a couple of frames a second. So you probably want to cache that as either a 10-bit or 16-bit DPX. And we've actually got some very good rescaling technology. So we can show that a 2K 10-bit DPX of a 4K 16-bit decode pretty much captures most of it if you lose a log curve for the DPX file.
Right, but the log...
But then that gives you real-time grading once you've done that. So you decode a couple of frames a second, and then you do real-time grading off that.
But presumably the difference is that once you get the decoded information from the R3D files, you're handling the log conversion to DPX. It's not RED's strong point going from R3D linear to DPX log. I mean, their 685 is not a particularly wonderful implementation. Are you doing that?
No, I mean, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that in our system. I mean, there's various different ways you can decode, and we've actually preserved all this because obviously people want to either have the same functionality they have in RED Cine or RED Alert. So all their color space settings are there, or you can just decode like into like linear space, a 16-bit, and then we can encode that to a log.
Now, do you support RED Space? Have you looked at RED Flex or and other color spaces from RED World?
That is actually in the SDK, so you can decode into RED Space if you want to.
Right.
Our view is that, you know, you probably want to take it as raw as possible so that you have access to every bit of color resolution. And typically in a color corrector, I mean, we spoke with RED about their recommended workflows, and they pretty much think we should, you know, in a mastering color grading environment, you don't really want to obey the metadata necessarily. You want to use that as a reference. So, okay, here's what came out of the camera in terms of the reference look.
But so would it be
you actually want to work with the raw data.
So would it be safe to say that your recommended workflow, if someone was doing a feature film finish, is to go linear to a 16-bit file that you're going to encode as a DPX file and continue on from there? Or is it your... Because there's not much point in a feature film workflow going into Rec. 709 color space.
No. So, yeah, I'd decode it from the 4K 16-bit. This all happens in memory, so there's no actual... There's no disk version of this, you know. It's all in memory, down to a 2K, say codec log. If you are going to go for film out, would be our recommended general workflow. And you can the difference between us and other implementations that's out there is you can at any point change the decode of an individual clip if you find that, oh, actually I wanted to do it this way, or and maybe I should try this, or let's have a look at the 4K 16 bits, see if there is any more detail there. It's not like you've locked in your parameters at that point, because you're still attached the conformist will attach the R3D, and you can change those parameters at any time.
And presumably you get or provide the user with full access to the metadata that's coming from the clip as well.
Yeah, I can't say for sure we've got 100% of it, but we're working towards that. I mean, obviously there's some things in our database that we didn't really consider before. So I think the first implementation doesn't contain everything, but it's our plan that as we roll out the next release, that we'll be able to address all the metadata fields they have. Certainly all the ones for conforming either through Final Cut or Avid are there. I mean, we've done some very successful conform tests.
And what about audio, clip-based audio from the R3Ds?
Again, today we have no support for that, and we're probably looking at that for sometime next year. I don't think the releases this year will contain audio, but we are looking at that.
So the current release is what version number, the one that includes the R3D?
3.6.
3.6. Okay.
And then the next major release is 4.0, which will be out in the new year.
Okay, and you were saying before actual users that have got that workflow and using it for Red include Ascent and, did you say the Mill, is that right?
Sent in the mail, yeah.
Right, cool. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us about that. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Cheers.
Well, look, that's fantastic, Mike. Anybody implementing R3D support gets my vote. That's great. I'd love to see some of these systems down our end of the woods.
Totally. It's actually, the guys have got some stuff happening now with Ascent Media and I think the Mill in London.
Excellent.
For people that are looking at it, it's obviously not anywhere near the penetration that Assimilate has or anything else, but as you say, it's good to, and healthy for the industry for more people to have access to R3D workflows, especially in color grading setups. Hey,
genius.
I think that's about it for us, isn't it, for this week?
I think that is. Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you.
We don't have a Red Room because we had the two interviews this week, or the two main stories this week.
Yep.
Somebody will send us some emails during the week, so I just want to cover off a couple of those. One was they were begging for us to put out these shows shorter and more regularly. And our point is just we need to remind you that we actually have full-time jobs. And so so we try and get them out every week or every fortnight, and we kind of average somewhere between the two. I don't think we've ever gone longer than 2 weeks, but if we're shooting 1 week and we have to skip it, then we'll pick you up the next week. We try and make them sensibly in length, but if you think that 1 hour is too long and you'd like us to cut out a whole section, feel free to tell us. But an option isn't for us to record twice as many show half as long,
no,
because getting us together is a scheduling issue.
And this kind of precision, quality product just can't, we just can't maintain that.
A precise, well-oiled audio machine.
You are. You make me look good. That is us for this episode. Next step, I'll be talking to Miller Tripods, a homegrown Australian story, which is fantastic. I got the factory tour and I got some really great info from the guys there. That's another excellent alternative. And plus there'll be more stuff.
Okay, talk to you later. See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.